I believe that poetry can support us in our well-being because it can, you can read a poem like you'd listen to a song, right? Just for a quick pick-me-up. You can meditate on a poem and get the same effects as sitting down for 5 minutes in silence. And you can read a poem and get that sense of being understood by the poem the same way that you would have with a 5-minute conversation with a friend.
Hey there. Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your fellow student and host. In this episode, I spoke with poet Lauren Decray. Lauren studied literature and grew up with the belief that you're either born creative or you're not. Events in her own life caused her to shift from analyzing works of art to creating them. Just earlier this year, she left her job at Google to pursue poetry full-time. She now leads creativity and poetry events in New York City for companies, individuals, and groups to help people find well-being through poetry. Listen to hear her talk about her journey and process, embracing her identity as a poet, and how poetry is more accessible to us than we might think. Hope you enjoy. Welcome, Lauren. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited too. Always a delight to get to wax poetic.
All right. So I would love to start by taking you back to your childhood and thinking about Lauren, age 7, 8, 9. In what ways did creativity come out?
My dad is French. My mom's American. And I would say that the American side was very pro arts and crafts, as I think Americans tend to be. And I think I noticed that wasn't necessarily the case with my little French friends around me. Always did a lot of drawing. Music was always on in the house, and I'd sing with my sister and my mom. And actually, I think it was around that age that I have a memory of writing poetry, which is slightly cheeky in the sense that I would get creative to make Christmas presents that didn't cost me my allowance. So the arts and crafts became very crafty. And I remember getting really into soaking sheets of paper in tea to make them look like old parchment. And then I'd write these poems on the sheets of paper and turn them into scrolls that were my Christmas gifts.
Wow. I love that. That's a great story. So then as you moved into adulthood, what really got you started with actually pursuing poetry?
It took a while, I think, between that story and making poetry my full-time practice. There was a gap of maybe 20 years, which is not an uncommon story. I'm learning as I work with more and more people around poetry. As a teenager, I stepped away from a lot of the arts and crafts and even the gymnastics that I was doing. My social life pretty much took over. I did study literature in both high school and in university. So I kept that thread of fascination for language as an art form. And most of my studies were focused on commenting the works of other people, right? Writing dissertations, essays, thesis about other people's novels and writings. So I never thought that I would find myself on the other side, on the creative side. And a fun fact is that, at least when I was growing up in French education, there is no such thing as creative writing classes.
Wow.
I really grew up with a belief that you are either born a creative or you're not. And that it's very much attached to this notion of talent, right? You're either talented or you're not, but there is no such thing as learning. And I remember talking about this with my sister when we watched the series Girls. So I was already in my early 20s, and the main character gets into a creative writing MFA course. And I remember us being like, what? Like, you can't learn creative writing. So yeah. And again, even though I was studying literature, but I think the studying of the literature put it even on a higher pedestal because you're working on these canons. The approach is extremely academic and analytical and intellectual. And it's, the feeling is there, but it's not being addressed as directly, I think. And that the feeling, the emotion, the curiosity is definitely what spurred me through my studies. But again, didn't ever feel like I could turn those emotions into anything of my own. And that changed through personal life events, which is where I think creativity lives, particularly, I think, in the like crevices of intimacy and discomfort. And for me, that was two things: a romantic breakup with my college boyfriend and journaling. And the way that those intersected was that I had made this big decision to leave this relationship. And suddenly I'm faced with these big questions of, okay, now who am I now that I'm not in this relationship? What do I actually want if I don't want that? And I had been writing, not quote unquote creatively, but I was did some journalism, a lot of academic writing. Before that, I'd been writing so much that the most natural thing for me was to pick up a pen and then to just start journaling every morning. And this is also when I discovered the artist's way. So these were my morning pages. And I found myself towards the end of these morning pages doing something completely unexpected, which was playing with language, objects of sound, like playing with the sound of words, playing with the rhythm of sentences. And there was something radically childlike and playful that was so different from the more straightforward, linear academic writing that I'd spent so much time doing. And that was my aha moment of, wait, is this what they call poetry? And that is how poetry came into my life.
Wow. So coming from that belief that someone's either born a creative or not, what was it like for you to reframe that?
There was a long period, I think, of just like being incredulous at this poetry that I was starting to write and almost just observing it with a bit of a side eye. Like, what is going on here? Mm-hmm. But I was living in New York at the time, and I think that helped tremendously reframe because I started taking writing workshops. Once I started writing, I had all these questions like, how do you decide to capitalize a verse? How do you decide on the structure of stanzas? Do you rhyme? Do you not rhyme, et cetera? So I signed up for a bunch of workshops, and the people in the workshops made me realize that being a poet doesn't mean being like an old white man locked up in a dusty study, which was the cliche I had in my mind. These people were teachers and poets and DJs and poets and data analysts and poets and et cetera, et cetera. So that was really helpful for me to realize that there's not a monolithic definition of the poet. And it took that image of the poet off of its pedestal and made it way more approachable. I think that was a really key moment. And then I think writing my book was definitely a pivotal moment. I decided as a resolution of January 2020, that was the year. I decided that was the year that I was going to write a book. I started doing that. The pandemic hit, definitely paused me in my tracks for a while. I went through some personal upheaval. And actually, as a way of getting through some of that, I threw myself into the making of the book. I collaborated with an artist because I wanted it to be not just text, but offer alternate doorways for people who don't necessarily read poetry to approach the book through visual arts.
Yeah.
And when the book came out, it was a bit of a selfish moment in a way where it was like, okay, I did the thing. I said I was going to write a book. I did the thing. And I did not expect what happened after that, which was the amount of recognition that I got. And I think I didn't expect it because I decided to self-publish. Some imposter syndrome in the process not being validated by gatekeepers. But that level of recognition that I got was definitely key in my recognizing for myself, wow, yeah, people see me as a poet. And I have this book, like I have this literal physical thing that is poetry. Who am I to say that I'm not a poet? So getting out of my own way and realizing like it's about the poetry more than it is about me. So start stepping up to show up for the poetry was what I learned.
It's really interesting because you talked a little bit about an identity of a poet and your preconceived notions of what that was and actually putting the book out there, feeling like you can claim that title. I'm curious, because you are not shy about claiming your title as a poet now, which I absolutely love. When was the moment that you started to first call yourself a poet? Was it after you put that book out?
It was starting to emerge before, but I still had a lot of blocks about calling myself a poet. Again, it still felt very grandiose. I still definitely felt that my output was the determining factor of identity. Mm-hmm. And I guess the story I just told about my book is in alignment with that idea that like our identities are validated by our output, which I have since grown to disagree with to a degree. After I put out the book, I think I had a thought that many creatives have, which is, what if I never write anything ever again? And Elizabeth Gilbert, I think, has a whole, wrote a beautiful book about that, which I actually haven't read, but just knowing it's out there comforts me. Big Magic.
Oh, yeah.
How do you keep on creating after you've made a thing, especially when it's received tremendous acclaim? Mm-hmm. How do you live up to that quote unquote standard? And I realized that determining my identity as a creative based on my output was very much mapped to our general capitalist productivist society that we live in, right? Where we're measured by the value of our output. Our self-value is pinned to the value of our output, how much you produce, how well you produce, and how much that production itself produces profit or whatever the metric that you're looking at. And I was looking at other artist friends thinking to myself, if you didn't paint for 6 months, I would not consider that you are no longer a painter. That's not what makes you a painter or a musician or a writer. And I started to realize that what makes artists is the practice of being an artist. So that can mean practicing that art without putting it out into the world, right? Mary Oliver says this, is that if you don't have a pile of terrible poems stacking up, you're not really doing the work. Behind every great book of poetry are like hundreds of quote unquote crap poems.
Yeah.
I think it was Ed Sheeran who also said that he practiced guitar every day, even if it sounded terrible, because when the moment came where inspiration came, he'd be ready to crank out that song because he'd practiced enough. So the practice to me became way more important. And what I think is great in poetry is that, of course, there's the practice of writing the poetry, but fundamentally, I believe that the practice of poetry is bearing witness to the invisible to make it visible. So it's bearing witness to how my neighbor walks into her home and has this really high-pitched squeal when her dog comes running to greet her, or at least that is the experience that I have from next door. So it's bearing witness to the looping thoughts in my mind and the stories that I keep on telling myself. And those can turn into poems potentially, but I think there is something poetic in that paying attention to the very small details. So in a way, it's convenient because you can be a poet just by practicing that sense mm-hmm. of attention without even necessarily writing. And so I think that takes a lot of pressure off, again, of defining yourself by the output. I hope that in the events that I put on and the workshops that I teach, we're breaking down those barriers of limiting identity, right? Versus the empowering identity of owning, wait, no, I am a poet even if I haven't published or shared or written any poems. But then there's the limiting side of that where I can only be a poet if I haven't done these things.
Yeah. No, I think that's such an interesting reframe that you've had in that journey from output to practice. And I find the more people I'm talking to about this, that is a consistent theme in the initial barrier, but then coming back to falling in love with the craft, the practice, and the actual doing of it is what makes you the person that you want to be or the identity.
Yeah, it took me a long time to learn that if you sit down with the idea, like a clear idea of the poem you want to write, you're missing out on the poetry. Mm-hmm. Because part of the magic and the joy is not actually knowing what's going to come out mm-hmm. and following the poem. And this always reminds me of one of the first pieces of advice that I got from the facilitator of one of my first writing workshops that I attended. And this is the piece of advice that the teacher gave me. He said, sometimes you have to get out of the way of the poem, right? You're going to sit down with a specific idea, but then this other poem clearly showed up and needed to be written. You shoehorn it into this one. That's fine. Next time, maybe just let go of that first idea. And that letting go of knowing the destination, of thinking that the poem that you're going to write has been one of the most humbling, but also most exciting experiences. And it's helped me reframe writer's block or the fear of the blank page of sitting down and being like, I don't know what I'm going to write, and turn that into, I don't know what I'm going to write.
It comes back to what you said at the beginning of bearing witness and staying open to what you're seeing and constantly observing. That part of the creative process is so fascinating. You can't plan. You don't know where it's going to go. And it almost also ties into improv, right? It's the yes and component of, okay, throw this idea out. How can we work with it? Not saying no to anything.
Totally. I think there's a lot that can be learned from improv for all creatives. I'm still low-key terrified by it, but the more I think about it, the more I'm like, this is what creativity is made of, that ability to listen to everything and then bring your little piece, your next word, your next joke, your next verse into the mix.
Right, and let go of the narrative that you were planning.
And then it's not about you.
Right.
I think in improv, the way I witness it, people are so not in their head. I can't imagine that they're thinking like, how funny am I sounding? How witty am I sounding? No, it seems like it's almost this transpersonal experience of you are so in tune with the group that you become the group in a sense.
Yeah, so present. Mm-hmm. So you also talked about the process of writing a lot of, I don't want to say bad, but
I know.
Perhaps bad poems in order to get to good ones. And I think, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think there's this really interesting thing that happens where it's like when you start getting interested in writing or some kind of creative act, it's like you have this, you have taste, right? You have like poems or works that you really love. And then you go and try to write and try to emulate them. And there's this gap, right? You're not there. And then there's this critic that comes with that of, look at what I've created. It's so far off from this wonderful work. So I wonder how you've worked through that.
It's been a journey for sure. I think I would start there with the idea of building awareness of who you're sitting down with when you sit down to write, and who in terms of all the voices in your head. If you're sitting down to write, and the critic is the one holding the pen, the process is switched around. The critic is great to potentially bring in as an editor when you're in the phase of editing. But when you sit down at first, I think really bringing in the inner child seems like the best companion for that. The inner child, the curious mind, maybe the meditator, if that's something you do, these parts of you that are really open, that have no expectation, that have no skin in the game. And I say the child because I think the child is actually like excited about the unknown, about falling over and not caring about it. There's no worry about hurting themselves. And I think that's really important, because sitting down with with attachment to outcome is just going to create a pretty boxed in poem. And I know that I've had to work with this a lot, where I wanted each poem to be something that I could share with the world. And a way that I got through that this was years ago when I first started, I gave myself the homework challenge to share a poem on social media every week, regardless of how edited or not it was. And it was what I'm now calling exposure therapy for my perfectionism.
Yeah.
And you speak of that gap, right, between you see something like a work that you really admire and you want to emulate it. It helped me reframe perfectionism in this journey with poetry. Is The Perfectionist Guide to Losing Control by an amazing therapist who I'm just going to remember her last name right now, which is Schaeffler. And she defines perfectionism as people, or perfectionists, because they tend to see it as an identity trait, not just a behavior. They're people who can see the gap between what is and what could be. First of all, I was like, okay, that's not too dramatic. And then she says that there is maladaptive perfectionism and adaptive perfectionism. She actually doesn't believe in like getting over your perfectionism or killing your perfectionism or curing your perfectionism. She believes in going from a maladaptive approach to an adaptive approach. And what the maladaptive looks like is that gap rules your life. You're just obsessed with bridging that gap versus the adaptive, where you can stand over here and be like, yep, I see that I can do better. There's that world over there that is not even just better, that's more this or that. Okay, I know I can get there. I have full trust that I can get there because I'm a perfectionist. How do I get there? And poetry has been an amazing tool in that, because there is no way to force the going from A to Z. You just have to practice patience. You have to practice listening. Again, there's this quote by a French poet called Jean Cocteau who says, the poet doesn't invent, he listens. What you can do is practice that. And I've almost tried to retrain my brain to look at every bad poem as a step forward to my goal, instead of being like, ah, I'm so bad, being like, no, like you took a step forward, and trusting that you will get to that good poem. And it always happens. I'm always shocked when I think that I'm out of poems, quote unquote. And then I'll see something, smell something, feel something, whip out my phone, write a thing. And I'm like, oh, it was right there, because it's not in my control. It's something to be uncovered. It's not mine to create or control. It's mine to uncover, again, listen for, discover, and find.
Yeah, it's such a great learning for all aspects of life. But I think you're right, it in a creative work or creative life, it gives you that opportunity to really practice that. It's very humbling.
Incredibly humbling.
There's also this concept of great artists steal, and looking at who your heroes are and the other poets and artists that you admire. And towards the beginning of an artist's journey, you're more in that emulating, mimicking, really trying to live up to their type of work. And that's your journey of finding your own style and seeing where do you make choices that are different from where they have. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about who some of the poets that you really have admired and how you've discovered your own style.
So one of the key insights that I had when I started writing poetry and had that aha moment was realizing how much more accessible poetry is than I had grown up thinking. Mm-hmm. Right? Thinking it's this very elite, almost mathematical thing, because the poems that I was studying were very form driven. A lot of meter, a lot of rhyme, mathematical. And realizing that poetry was so accessible, first of all, I was like, the world needs to know this. And part of realizing that accessibility wasn't just through my own experience of playing with language and starting to write quite spontaneously, but was discovering English language poets who wrote in a way that is definitely poetry, but can almost read like prose. And I think of Mary Oliver, evidently, who's, I think, a great example of somebody that studied the craft, that studied the forms, the intricate canons of poetry, and decided, or I think infused, the simplicity of her poems with that back end knowledge of how complex and subtle poetry can be. Her simplicity is the tool towards depth. I find something similar with David White's work, also almost like prose, but has this quality of prayer, that the depth of his experience. Other people that come to mind, there's two people that come to mind, definitely Ocean Vuong and Tracy K. Smith. And both of them, to me, use language in uncommon ways that remind us that we all have something in common. And I think I remember reading Ocean Vuong's Night Sky with Exit Wounds and feeling like I was learning English almost as a new second language, even though I'm a native speaker of English.
Wow.
And the capacity to make you like rediscover your native tongue in that way is brilliant. Speak of bearing witness. It's let me show you not just an incredible like symbol or object that I'm writing about, but let me show you the language itself. Let me turn it inside out and show you the seams of it. And I think the title of the book does exactly what I'm talking about, where the title is Night Sky with Exit Wounds. I have no idea what that means. But my whole body and heart and emotional being is just, yes, Like, I get the meaning without understanding it. There's this quote by, this reminds me of a quote by T.S. Eliot, who says, genuine poetry can communicate before it's understood. And I think Ocean Vuong, Tracy K. Smith, the way that they turn language on itself, so it doesn't read like prose at all. Your mind, I think your rational analytical brain, is constantly having to reassess how it's understanding language. It keeps it on its toes constantly. But I think it's doing that. It's like helping us realize that we can understand, or we can communicate without that analytical, rational understanding that we put so much emphasis on in our daily lives.
That's really interesting when words hit you in that way.
And actually, to answer your question about my journey from that to finding my voice, I'm still very much in that process. And I think I had a lot of urgency and trepidation when I first started. Like, I need to find my voice. I'm at a phase where, again, I've practiced and just realized the humbling practice of faith that is writing and practicing poetry. And I'm at a point where I'm like, I don't have my voice. And I know this not because I'm being hard on myself. I know this because I just don't feel it in my bones. But I trust that I'm walking the path towards finding it. And that path is going to look like trying out writing like Mary Oliver. There are definitely times where I feel like, yeah, this is a Mary Oliver poem, and I just channeled her, and fine, I'm trying that on. And I need to try on to feel where it's too tight for me, or it's too loose for me, you know, until I find the right size. I think of Ocean Vuong, and suddenly I'm like, oh, don't write in such a direct way. Let's really try breaking the grammar, breaking the typical semantics of a sentence. There's actually another poet that I love who I discovered on Instagram called Isabel Correa. And I think she's, in my mind, I'm like, this is the poetry that I want to write. But I know that's not the case, and that my poetry will be something, again, different. Maybe not what my mind wants me to write, and it'll be something different. But she writes in a way that's both approachable, and then boom, she'll put words together that you really did not expect. And that balance of the prosaic and the more experimental, the balancing act that I'm practicing right now. And no idea where it leads me. Maybe it'll lead me to write really, I don't know, woo spiritual poems that my intellectual brain completely criticizes. And that'll be my journey to accept and be like, okay, I don't get to choose in a certain sense.
There's that quote that's something along the lines of, don't wait until you know who you are as an artist to start.
Yeah, right.
It's a constant
discovery.
Yeah. And also, I love that you incorporate these different poets into your writing prompt process too. It's because you learn things from there as if you're this person or in the style of,
yeah,
but you wind up changing it up. So
yeah, I think you have to try mimicking someone to see where you fail.
Right.
In that failure is where you are.
Or where it doesn't feel as natural to you.
Exactly. Where it feels like now you're drawing outside the lines. Like you couldn't perfectly write like them.
Yeah.
Where is that space outside the lines is like where you are.
Yeah. I also want to talk about, because I think there's, in sharing your work, there's, on the one hand, there's the perfectionist gap, which we've talked a little bit about. But then there's also, when you're sharing work that is deeply personal, there's this, there's a huge vulnerability to that. And I'm also a huge fan of David White. And something that just really speaks to me and what he writes a lot about is this concept of hiding and how things that are real have to start hidden until they're ready to be seen by the world. And so I'm curious, as you have gone through your journey of sharing work that's so personal, how have you gotten through that? And
it's a great question. The first answer that comes to mind was that as a rather, or I would say historically shy person, writing was always the easier way for me to disclose versus talking. And there is almost this game in poems of revealing and simultaneously hiding, where I felt like poems were this safe space to get vulnerable, but at the same time, I'm like, these are poems. Yes, I wrote them, but how limiting to think that they are directly about me. Like the speaker in the poem doesn't have to be me. It can be anyone. It can be multiple different personas, I think. And so it actually felt, when I first started sharing poems, like one of the safest ways to start disclosing myself. Again, because a poem is not an autobiography. It's not a documentary. It's not a direct account of me, but there is still something of me in it. And I get a similar question when people ask me, how do you share your poems out loud? At your performances, at open mics, that feels incredibly vulnerable. And the answer that I ended up on there was that I realized it's not about me. Once the poem is out in the world, it becomes its almost like an autonomous being, not quite like a child, but you could use that metaphor of birthing a work of art. And then it takes on its own meaning because people are going to read it the way they want to read it. I surrender control of meaning once I put it out in the world. So I would, and I still do remind myself when I get stressed out about presenting my poems in public, it's not about me, what we were saying about the improv. It's about me being the best steward for these poems. Mm. How can I best speak them? Almost like a singer would practice singing a song. And how do I get that note right and this lyric out there, right? How can I best convey these poems out in the world? Because they deserve that. And so the exposure feels so much less, again, because it's almost like I'm an actor stepping on stage to make the play the main thing that we're seeing, or the character the main thing that we're seeing. And in this case, it's the poems become the object that is being seen versus me, Lauren Ducre, 33 years old, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I think that detachment is so interesting, and you're relinquishing control of the poem's meaning, of what it means to you, of your hold on it in the world. Can you give an example of a time when it's been surprising what someone has maybe taken from something that you've put out there in the world?
I am always surprised by how much people resonate with pieces that I wrote in specific circumstances that I obviously know about. And I'm thinking of this one piece that is not actually in my book, but it's a poem that I share pretty often that starts out with, I want to crack open your brain. Look at all the bits and pieces, all the nooks and crannies, all the memories of your granny. And it goes on, in my experience, to talk about the fascination of wanting to know someone, wanting to literally get in their brain, and recognizing that as much as you can observe them, visit their thoughts, you can never own any of that. You're only always just a visitor of their world. And I've shared this poem many times, and I'm always fascinated by how people share afterwards, how it's resonated with a specific relationship that they're going through. And that openness just feels really moving because I remember who I was writing about. And I hoped in writing the poem that it wouldn't be limited to that. And getting to witness people tell me at these open mics that I host, wow, this spoke directly to this situation that I'm going through right now, never ceases to blow my mind and remind me of the constant actualization of poems and of works of art that I think are open enough to allow that conversation to happen over and over again, which is really precious to me. And seeing this one poem be reopened and reinterpreted year after year gives me a lot of solace.
It speaks to the personal and universal aspects of these works of art.
Yes, it's definitely a common saying in the world of poetry, which is the more personal a poem, the more universal.
So you talked about your open mics. I think also the community aspect and setting of sharing is really important. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that and what you've found to create the right space and environment to be able to allow people to share these vulnerable works.
Yeah, so we started these open mics with my friend Ross because we both recognize the collective healing power of poetry, to say it simply. And I think that can sound a little woo, but historically, poetry was a very collective, public art form. I was recently at a workshop with the Irish poet Padraig Ó Tuama, and somebody asked him a question about the relationship between politics and poetry. And that's a politics in that sense of public life. And he said, growing up in Ireland, poetry is part of public life. We grow up learning poems in school. It is just part of the way that we interact with each other as members of society. We hit on that because we both write and appreciate poetry, and it's been such a healing tool for us individually, and we wanted to bring it to a group of people. And what was important to me in setting the stage was conveying to folks the accessibility of poetry, right? So the fact that poetry, first and foremost, is music more than it is this intellectual construct. And there's studies in neuroscience that show that the parts of your brain that light up when you listen to music are the same that light up when you listen to poetry, because poetry uses language in this musical way. And in one of the studies, they even asked the participants whose brains had just been scanned and whose brains had reacted to poetry to then identify on a sheet of paper which lines they heard respected poetic constraints and which lines did not. And they couldn't necessarily point out those lines on a sheet of paper. Again, even though their brains had reacted to the lines that respected poetic constraints and did not react to the lines that were just in prose. In other words, I like to say that anybody can understand poetry. You don't need to analytically be able to recognize it to have a physical and emotional appreciation of it. The same way you don't have to know how to write music or explain music to have a musical experience. So that is very much the framing of these events. It's that easy. An invitation to let your analytical mind take a back seat, receive the poetry like you would a meditation. And I also bring people into a meditative state to practically help them let go of the thinking mind and ease into the body. And then people get to have this immersive experience of a poem being read to them. And then they get to discuss it with other people and realize how many different interpretations of one poem there can be, which I love because I think poems are one of the rare places where we can get personal without taking things personally. Again, I think disagreement in public spaces is usually really polarized and quite loud and aggressive. And in this case, you get to sit with a few other people and discuss how differently you heard the exact same poem and maybe be wowed by somebody's perspective because you're like, I would have never heard that word in that way. Thank you. Now I get a richer experience of the same poem. So you're getting to practice empathy as well. So all of these elements of the musicality, the mindfulness, the empathy are what we tie into these events to then open the mic to folks to realize, okay, this is not about me. This is about allowing other people to also get something from my share and just try out being a steward to whatever art form you're sharing. These open mics are not just about poetry. We really encourage anything. But the idea is really making poetry this accessible tool for communal, collective healing.
Well, and having been to one, they're very moving. I know you're also doing a lot of this work in other settings now. And it's so interesting just how powerful that primer that you do is and guiding people through this experience and then having them see the openness and the ability to communicate in a different way. It's such a powerful tool for corporations, for other settings, and for having these really challenging conversations that we have as a society.
Yeah, I've directly used this in corporate settings. So I used to work at Google and started offering these poetry for well-being workshops during COVID, mainly because I wanted to find a way to support my team and help us stay connected as we all went remote. And it was really fascinating to introduce people or to reassure people again in their ability to understand poetic language and to connect with coworkers in this vulnerable way around the table that is the poem. Again, the poem becomes this proxy for us to get really deep, but we don't have to do it directly. It's not about you sharing about your personal life directly to a therapist. It's about the poem opening up these little doors for all of us to walk through. And I tried these out as pilots mainly, and then kept on doing them and turned them into a full program that still is running at Google. I left a few months ago to bring this work to other companies, having seen hundreds of people sign up, hundreds of people realize how much they needed this open, creative, and vulnerable space to connect with coworkers on other things than their core jobs and projects. But also hundreds of people leaving these workshops feeling really energized and empowered in their creativity. I think one of the main pieces of feedback I've gotten is, Lauren, after going to this workshop that does not involve writing, I started writing again, or like I started painting again. I started dancing again. And that's super humbling, right? I'm doing this because the boilerplate is that I believe that poetry can support us in our well-being, because you can read a poem like you'd listen to a song, right? Just for a quick pick-me-up. You can meditate on a poem and get the same effects as sitting down for 5 minutes in silence. And you can read a poem and get that sense of being understood by the poem the same way that you would have with a 5-minute conversation with a friend. Those are the three ways that the workshop shows you can use poetry as a tool for well-being. But then there's all these other effects of being energized, being empowered in your creativity, wanting to connect with your coworkers more, that, yeah, push me to bring it outside of the world of Google. Because if there's that many people at Google that are interested, there are other folks outside. And the business world, I think, needs a counterbalance to the very left brain analytical intelligence that is wonderful that we have, but it is twice as powerful when we have the right brain, creative, emotionally intelligent side that is as online as the other one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such important work. And hearing your story of starting in the analytical brain and discovering this other part of yourself and now fully integrating the two, I think for so many people, creativity, poetry feels so inaccessible and feels reserved only for artists or for people who proudly claim those titles. And it can take a long time for us to come around to the accessibility of it, but then see the positive impacts that it can have in our lives, even in just little ways.
Oh, it's tremendous. And one of my biggest soapboxes is people who think they're not creative. I'm like, being human is being creative, right? Like your body is literally like regenerating cells at every second that we're having this conversation, right? It is creative by essence. And the way you approach any challenge can be creative. And we're actually asked in the corporate world to be creative. Leadership has such a component of creativity, because every different human that you're going to be leading and working with is going to be a new conversation, a new situation to deal with. So I think we're actually asked to be extremely creative, but we're unfortunately not given the tools to do that. We're given very rational, analytical tools to reach innovation, which you're only going to get there halfway, because again, you're only using kind of half of your brain, quote unquote. I know the metaphor of the left brain and half and right brain is somewhat controversial, but I think we're missing half of the toolbox to be as performing as companies ask us to be.
And it's funny, because earlier you recited part of your poem, which was about cracking open a mind. Yeah. And as we're talking about this, I think something that I'm personally fascinated with is balancing this practical and creative sides of the brain internally. I wonder if you could describe a little bit within yourself how you see these sides of yourself, the analytical and now the creative that you've cultivated.
Like how I relate to them?
Yeah. Are they in conflict? Are they working together? Where have you gotten and where are you continuing to?
They're dating. And like fourth date. There's like interest. They've gotten over some first blocks and judgments, but there's still a trepidation. There's still a hesitation. They're not quite sure yet.
But they're not warring.
They're not warring. Yeah. There's attraction, but they're trying to figure out how to dance together, I would say. And that's taken years and years. I think the main practice for me has been learning to notice how and when my analytical brain shows up, which was hard because it was 100% of my existence for such a long time that it's hard to notice the outlines of something that takes up all the space because it is, it's like, it feels like it's the sky. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, oh no, it's just like a really big cloud. So noticing when my analytical mind shows up and trying my best to really make space for the creative impulse. And mm-hmm. it can be really quiet. And I'll give you actually a very specific example of how I started writing songs, which I know you'll appreciate.
Yes. Yes. Excited about this.
As a poet and somebody who loves music and who, yeah, plays the guitar, sings songs by other people for a really long time, I always thought, okay, I'm a poet. How have I not figured out how to write songs yet? Hmm. Songwriting felt like something that was behind this window pane, and I could see people doing it, but it was just beyond reach. It was a paradigm. It was in a different world. And I recently went on a vocal transformation retreat, which has been very helpful work for me. And about midway through that week, I'm sitting after lunch and I get what feels like a thought, very unremarkable. And the thought is, go get your guitar and play around with it. Hmm. Okay. I get my guitar and I start playing around with these chords that I'm figuring out. I'm not a master of guitar by any means, but I'm just listening to the sounds and I start doing this chord progression and words start coming up. And I think to myself, don't get tripped up on the words. They're almost like placeholders. You do not have to write the most epic poetic lyrics here. Literally just get some words out. And I start writing bits down. Rhymes are coming oddly easily to me and it's feeling really nice. And after about 10 minutes, I turn to my friend who's just laying in the grass next to me. And I'm like, Aura, I think I'm writing a song.
Oh my gosh.
And after that, what happened blew my mind, which was that my mind and body could not stop writing this song.
Wow.
So the melody just kept on coming in my mind. I had to like lunge to get my phone to record it because I don't actually know how to write music properly. So I just had to hum it into my phone. And this happened for about 24 hours. I remember even being in bed and it's 11 p.m. on retreat, which feels really late. And my mind is just, here's a bridge. And I'm like, okay, damn it. Got to get my phone, record this bridge. And a day later, I was sitting down and I had the full song and I play it one whole time through and I start crying and laughing at the end, which I call crafting, which happens to me in these moments of deep connection and just deep realization that something has happened, like something of beauty has happened. And I think in that moment, it was almost this joy and grief that I had made up such a story in my head of how complicated it was to write a song. And it had just happened in the course of 24 hours by me listening again. By me listening rather than trying to control the creative process.
Wow. Yeah.
And since it has been that practice of hearing what sounds like a thought truly that could get lost in the millions of thoughts that I have in my mind. And the thought is always, go and get your guitar. And I go, I get my guitar and I've written 6 songs since in that same process of sitting down, not knowing what I'm going to write, playing some chords, being like, oh, I like the sound of this. Letting the lyrics come out, not judging them, allowing what I think I formerly would have judged as really silly, like pseudo spiritual songs to just be what they are.
Wow. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I can't wait to hear them.
Such a fun process. And that is what I'm realizing. It's so fun.
Yeah.
And poetry has, I think even in the early days, felt like a bit of a labor of love. Mm. And this songwriting process has been just full fun and joy and playfulness.
I love the openness and the child part that you're bringing to it. So I did want to ask you maybe more on the analytical side of your brain about AI.
Totally.
You previously worked at Google training AIs to be more empathetic. And I'm curious how you view AI as a creative and as a poet and how you approach it.
I'd love to start by reading this poem that I think is brilliant. Not by me. It's by this amazing poet called Joseph Fasano. And the title is "For a Student Who Used AI to Write a Paper." Because I think it addresses the fear of AI producing the artwork. And I'll say more on that. This poem goes, "Now I let it fall back in the grasses. I hear you. I know this life is hard now. I know your days are precious on this earth. But what are you trying to be free of? The living? The miraculous task of it? Love is for the ones who love the work." And I think that poem to me captures how AI can't replace the process of being an artist. Again, if you're going to a large language model and just asking it to write a poem for you, I think you're missing out on the poetry. Mm-hmm. If you're going to Midjourney and just expecting it to pop out an image that you otherwise would have drawn or painted, I think you're missing out on the process of painting. And we've spoken a lot about process here. So from the artist's perspective, I'm not worried because I will always want to write. I will always want that process. Now, where I think things can get worrisome is that if it becomes too easy to generate good poems, maybe there'll be less incentive to write them yourself. Maybe there'll be less of a glimpse of the beauty of the process itself. Because like we said, the process is hard and it can be grueling. And if you can just cut straight to the result, why not? But I think this is an opportunity for us to maybe communicate more about the beauty of the process and emphasize that more. That being said, I think the more interesting pieces that I've seen do use AI as part of their process. And actually, AI and creativity is not new. And I know this because I'm teaching a class at Columbia with other teachers about generative AI and creativity. There was a painter in the 80s whose name I can't remember right now, but he created pretty much a robot with an algorithm that could paint paintings based on his prompts. And what he found most interesting, and actually why he created this algorithm and this robot, was because he realized that he could learn so much about the process of painting, about his creative process, by having to create this tool that would go through it. And I think that's what we're realizing. If you type into ChatGPT and write me a poem about X, it's not going to be good. You have to get really granular in the prompting. And to do that, you have to think of, wait, what does make a good poem? Like, how do I teach this AI to write a good poem? Which just brings you back to teaching a human to write a poem. You have to think about what makes the art. And so I think some of the best pieces that I've seen out there are people that get really nerdy and granular and using ChatGPT and then using that prompt to go into Midjourney and then really getting curious about how Midjourney works. And then you get an awesome output. But I'm just seeing this as the process is evolving and it's changing and we're just using different tools. The whole conversation to be had about the fact that the visual tools are trained on corpuses of artwork that are copyrighted and we're not paid for. But in the conversation about process, I think that it's similar potentially to acoustic musicians discovering that they can make music completely electronically. I don't think less acoustic musicians today. I don't think we have less guitar players. I haven't checked the data, but I have not seen a significant drop in musicians as the DJ scene gets bigger. The monetization of all that has certainly shifted, and I don't know enough about that to speak to how much acoustic musicians are suffering because electronic music is on the up, et cetera. But in terms of process, I think it can actually teach us a lot about how we write and how we create and how we make images and music and all the other art forms.
Yeah, wow. And you're right. It causes us to bring so much more awareness and actually learn so much more about the process, which can be this intangible thing that's hard to codify, actually. So it does take that extra metacognition to be able to use AI in an effective way.
And this is just my personal take. It's that I think there's that you can have this like metacognitive approach to understanding the process. And that's very analytical and that can be interesting. And it always has to be balanced with the organic creative process, right? When you can't think your way through a poem again, but it's, you understand, you study all the poets, you study all the forms, you practice mimicking so that you can write better. And so that's my point of view is, yes, I can learn about the writing process by using ChatGPT and exploring how to co-create a poem with ChatGPT. And I don't see my personal organic process of sitting in the morning with my cup of tea and writing on a piece of paper disappearing as a result of that. Maybe I was privileged to discover that process again before the shortcut of LLMs existed. Yeah. That's why I love this poem by Joseph Fasano, because he's a teacher and he's talking to his students that arguably are growing up with this shortcut readily available. How can we communicate the pleasure and the playfulness and the beauty of the process?
Yeah, that's an amazing poem.
Lauren, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I guess before we wrap up, I'll just toss it to you to see if there's any additional thoughts that you have or anything that you wanted to share as it relates to poetry, well-being, creativity.
There is a poem that's waiting to crack them open so that they remember that they're whole. Hmm. And it's a question of finding it, because I totally hear that there are poems that can feel really daunting and difficult to understand. And they're almost taunting you with how mysterious they are. But there is a poem that will be a mirror for you to see yourself in really brightly and beautifully. Yeah.
I love that. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
What a great way to start the day. Super inspiring.
I hope you enjoyed my episode with Lauren Ducray. To work with Lauren or get in touch with her, you can find her at her website, laurenducray.com. She's also active on LinkedIn and Instagram. Her book, Tongues Tied, is available on Amazon, and her album of poetry and music is also available on Apple Music and YouTube.